From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As I'm sure you're aware, oil is an indispensable part of modern life, from plastics to pharmaceuticals, fertilizers to your gas tank. It's hard to imagine life without it. But oil is also a finite resource. In his latest book, Blood of the Earth, The Battle for the World's Vanishing Oil Resources, Dilip Hero discusses the rise of our dependence on oil and the role it's played in modern politics and warfare. Nation Books is the publisher, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Hero back to my show today. It's always a pleasure. How long have we been using oil as a source of energy?
Oh, for a very long time. I think, as you know, originally the proper drilling of oil and commercial extraction of oil actually happened in the Baku area in 1846. And at that time...
That's Azerbaijan?
Near Baku in Azerbaijan. Yes, it was a part of the Tsarist Empire. And the bureaucracy was so slow that it was only 2 years later on that it was recognized by the Tsar. Of course, as you know, that if you read Daniel Juergens' book, he says in 1859, Titusville, Pennsylvania, as if it were the first time. No, the USA was 11 years later on. In fact, before Titusville, oil was found in Canada, near Alberta. But in terms of relying on oil, initially it was kerosene used for lighting and so on and so forth.
So that's what they thought oil, that the value of this oil that was popping up was. Now, the case of Titusville, which is where so many people, as you say, connect the discovery of oil, those oil fields are totally drained dry, aren't they?
Absolutely. But, you know, I can tell you one figure which amazed me. You see, I've been to Midland, Texas, you know, and of course I saw these, you know, wells as well as the donkey pumps and so on and so forth. Then I went to Qatar, the Gulf state of Qatar, which among other things has Al Jazeera. And I found that in the U.S. There are about 500,000 working oil wells. I'm excluding offshore. Big fields. Mm-hmm. And their average output is 10 barrels a day. I went to Qatar. There, the average output of one single oil well in Qatar and in Kuwait is 2,500 barrels.
Well,
250 times more. Oh. And you never see anywhere a donkey pump because the pressure is high and they don't need the donkey pumps.
Well, there was a time when you couldn't travel through Texas or California without seeing them, the donkey pumps, and now most of them have disappeared. So it's obvious that we've pretty much drained our, at least the continental United States, the contiguous 48 states of most of our oil. When did oil become the most utilized source of energy, surpassing coal?
I think in the USA, it would be around 1910 to 1920.
Is it that early?
Yes, the key point here, Leonard, is that, you know, when there was a marriage of internal combustion engine with the petroleum product of diesel or gasoline, that's where the whole thing took off. That happened in 1905. See, before that, there was a competition. The internal combustion engine was fueled also by electric batteries and so on, and by steam. But once this marriage took place in 1905, the thing took off. Secondly, most importantly, it's not only in civilian life. The arrival of oil changed the nature of warfare. It was in the middle of World War I. In 1916, there was the marriage of the tank engine with petroleum. And that gave the generals a much greater field of operation. See, before that, they had only horses, cavalry. Okay, horses have to rest, they have to eat, and watering, et cetera, and so in each day, a general could go maybe 10, 15 miles. But once he had tanks, he could go 50 miles.
It also gave us air warfare in World War I. So yeah. It really changed everything.
But I think before that, actually, you know, the Navy changed. Because it was the American ship owners who switched from coal to oil, and they made huge profits for three reasons. One, oil took less space on the ship, so they had more for commercial purposes. Two, less people were employed because, you know, coal shoving into the boilers, my God, you need an army. And thirdly, the speed acceleration was very good. Now, that principle was used first by William II, Kaiser in Germany, and he changed from coal to oil for the Navy, and on the other side was Winston Churchill. He was a Lord of Admiralty, and he said, we are going to do the same thing. But the reason, if you have your ships which are on oil, they can go faster than the enemy ships and then turn around and then fire at them. And that is where the whole thing changed. You know, the arrival of oil became as important as the arrival of the gunpowder in 1041.
Now, both oil and coal are carbons. Are they formed relatively similarly?
No, I think the oil and gas are, shall I say, advanced stage. You know, I mean, if you look at historically human history, we started with wood, you know, trees, etc.
I meant when they're formed by the earth itself. Were they both formed from the same raw materials?
Yeah, I think material is the same.
Millions of years ago?
Yeah, I think, you know, there is hydrogen and carbon. You know, and of course, you know, what you get, the peat and the coal, and then, of course, if you compress it much further, and if deeper, then it turns into oil, and if you compress it even much further, it turns into gas. So when, as you know, when you're actually exploring for hydrocarbons, which is the right term, you get natural gas and oil mixed. But if you go deeper, then you get only natural gas. So I think that essentially what it means, the earth is made up of two elements, carbon and hydrogen. And oil and gas have the same elements in a much more concentrated form.
So this takes billions of years to form.
Yeah, I think that there are what you call oil rocks, which are 260 million years old. And there are others which are 300 million years old, you know. And what's happened if you are looking at the Persian Gulf area, that, you know, that that was a very large area, and it is concentrated, and that's where oil has got trapped. You see, oil is formed, but it can, you know, come up through, you know, these pores and disappear in the atmosphere. But if there is a stopper, if there's salt, which acts as a stopper, and it traps it down there. And if you're lucky, if you live in that part of the world, like in the Persian Gulf, then you have two-thirds of the world oil reserves in that area.
My guest is Dilip Hero, who writes regularly for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Observer, the Sunday Telegraph, the Guardian, and the Nation, the author of 28 books, the most recent, Blood of the Earth, The Battle for the World's Vanishing Oil Resources, from Nation Books. So is it possible that we can still discover more oil? Aren't there still some promising places like the Caspian Basin?
Absolutely. If you were to talk to Dick Cheney, he will give you a very long list. As you know, Dick Cheney and his oil executives got together, and remember, in May 2001, they issued this new policy on oil, energy, and they would say they have made a list of countries, and nine of them are important. I have taken each of these countries and blown them to pieces, except one, Kazakhstan. All other countries, including Mexico, in about 10 years' time, there will be increase in oil, but their own consumption is rising so fast they will use up all of it. So that by year 2020, the countries which will be able to export oil will be mostly in the Persian Gulf, the Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. Outside in Central Asia, only Kazakhstan. And in the rest of the world, I'm sorry to give bad news to Dick Cheney, Venezuela.
Venezuela, but what about Alaska? Isn't Alaska the great hope for the Bush administration?
But you see, the amount is so small. If you look at, you know, every year the BP publishes, you know, what they call the world energy resources, including coal, nuclear power, et cetera, and if you look up those figures, the most reliable figures in the world, the U.S., the United States, has 3% of the world oil reserves. and the Gulf area has 63%. And then, of course, there is oil in Central Asia, but as I said, only Kazakhstan will have enough to export. So I think on the whole, and very simple, you know, on page 56 of my book, very simple chart, just look at the chart. It says demand, and then recovery. That means, you know, the actual new findings. And you see the way these graphs are going. The demand is rising. The actual oil that we are finding is declining. Over the past 20 years or so, the world is finding only 40% of the oil it is using. So, you know, so we can't actually have a long discussion. I mean, we can have a long discussion until you give me time, you know. But the major discussion is not whether oil is here, there, whether it will reach a peak in 10 years or 20 years. The point is that if you are using 100 units and finding only 40 units new, you are on a losing wicket, you know. And, of course, you can see, I mean, of course, what's called the Hubert's curve.
Yeah, what about that? Yeah.
Oh, Hubert, the great guy. Of course, he's dead. But, you know, Hubert, you know, American geophysicist. His first name was Marion King Hubert, and he was a genius. He did lots of scientific papers, and then he worked for Shell in Houston. And in 1956, he delivered a paper at the American Petroleum Institute in Houston, in which he said, going by mathematical formulae, that the 48 states of America, contiguous states of America, the oil will reach its peak in the late 1960s. And he was, you know, slapped on the wrist by his own bosses. Even 5 minutes before he was to give the paper, said, don't do it. Marion King Hubert, don't do it. But he was, a very strong-minded man. He went ahead, and lo and behold, in 1970, the United States of America peaked oil product of 11.7 million barrels. And last year, it was 7.4 million barrels a day.
But I guess the problem is that every time the oil companies want to raise prices, they talk about this as a diminishing resource. And in the 70s, we heard that oil was fast being depleted. Prices went up. And here we are, awash in oil again.
No, it's not. We are awash in oil. You see, Leonard, if you look at another chart, which, you know, which is called what you might call the it's called a bell chart. You know, see some basics. Oil is a mineral. Like any other mineral, it is finite, and like any other mineral, it follows the bell curve. It reaches a peak, and then it starts to decline, and that decline is terminal, you know. And of course, it won't disappear. You see, I am not here to be, you know, doom and gloom that it's going to disappear. It will be another 100 years before it disappears. But the price will be high.
But you're also saying that two other things are happening. We're making more and more things out of petroleum, and you have this alphabetical listing of petroleum products in the book that is shocking in some cases because there are so many different things and things I never would have associated with it. And there are developing countries that are going to demand more and more. Things were a lot easier when the U.S. and Western Europe were pretty much the only ones. Now suddenly we have China, India, perhaps Brazil, and a few other countries that are going to increase their dependence on oil.
Absolutely. I think, see, you cannot actually expand your economy unless you have this energy source, which is, and oil is the most efficient, most versatile, and, you know, in terms of the alphabet that you mentioned, I start A with aspirin and B for benzene, you know, all the way I come to X for xylene, Y for yon, and for Z, I don't know. So if any of you are...
But there are a number of wonder drugs, and isn't that a fear that since new drugs are developed out of petroleum, that if we start running out of petroleum, we may very well have to find new ways to develop wonder drugs?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is my argument, which is that, you see, if you talk of, say, natural gas can only, you know, run automobiles and create electricity, or nuclear power only electricity, but oil is so versatile. It gives us fertilizers, pharmaceuticals, plastics, and so on and so forth. Therefore, we as human beings should develop other fuels for vehicles. And that's where you actually have, you know, in Chapter 10 heading, and that's where I'm not a gloom and doom person. You will see Chapter 10 where it says cars, internal combustion engine and gasoline a divorce on the horizon. So you see, as the cars, you know, hybrid cars have come in, and their next step is hydrogen cells. And there again, Toyota in Japan, they already have hundreds of cars running on hydrogen cells. They have a supply system in the streets of Tokyo. And I think 10 to 15 years' time, many of these cars will be run on hydrogen cells and even on solar panels. And that is our saving grace.
Well, there was an electric car developed by General Motors. Many people swore by it. And then GM recalled them all and destroyed them.
Precisely, you see, because what happened, you know, you mentioned earlier about 1970s and 1985. See, what happened during the Iran-Iraq War in the mid-1980s, the Saudis and Kuwaitis flooded the market to bring down the oil price to hurt the economy of Iran. I mean, something like this is going on right now. Anyway, so, and therefore oil became quite cheap. And we had Ronnie Reagan in the White House, and he's just, you know, he was deregulating everything, et cetera, et cetera. And that created this feeling that, you know, as if oil is around for a long time, it's cheap, et cetera, et cetera. But what I'm saying is that as human beings, as residents of one planet, we should really try to save that particular, you know, use for oil, for vehicles, where others can take over.
My guest is Dilip Hiro, H-I-R-O. His latest book, Blood of the Earth, The Battle for the World's Vanishing Oil Resources, published by Nation Books, will continue right after this. We're back with Dilip Hiro, author of 28 books, the most recent, Blood of the Earth, The Battle for the World's Vanishing Oil Resources, from Nation Books, and something of a departure for you because the previous books all dealt with the Middle East in some way, although it's impossible to talk about oil without talking about the Middle East and without talking about Saudi Arabia.
No, of course not possible. Of course, because, as I said earlier, 2/3 of oil reserves are in the Middle East. And since you mentioned Saudi Arabia, interestingly enough, in terms of America using oil as an instrument of foreign policy, it really became very obvious during World War II, i.e. as soon as USA entered World War II after December 1941, they really supplied a lot of oil to the Allies, and they, you know, over-pumped oil on continental USA, which worried the officials, and they said, my God, we are using it up too quickly. So they looked around, and where could they find a lot of oil? Saudi Arabia. And they wanted to help Saudi Arabia. It was a fairly poor country then. And there was a Land Lease Act, 1941. But Franklin D. Roosevelt said, well, I can't help this king, Abdulaziz, known as Ibn Saud, because he is a dictator. And he's not a Democrat. He's not fighting with us. But then they said, you know, just say that the defense of Saudi Arabia is central to defense of the United States. 1943, that's what Franklin D. Roosevelt did. And since then, as you have seen, the world politics has changed. Soviet Union came and went, and everything has changed except this nexus between the Saudi Arabia and United States remains intact, despite the fact that 15 out of 19 hijackers of 9/11 were Saudi citizens. And because that is what the word is oil, O-I-L.
And oil from Saudi Arabia always seems to be our fallback approach. Whenever the price really goes up high, the Saudis will then pump a bit more and bring the prices down. As a favor to the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what they're doing. You see, because, you know, Saudi Arabia remains what's called a swing producer, and by increasing and decreasing their output, they can basically manipulate prices. And that was the main reason, since we started talking about oil and warfare, that was the main reason when Bush Sr., when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and occupied it, he, being the real and successful oil man, unlike his son, whom I call a failed oil man, Bush Sr. understood within 5 minutes that Iraq has 10% of world oil reserves, Kuwait has 10%, and if he incorporates Kuwait into his country, then he would have 20%.
Well, but he also said that Kuwait was stealing oil from under Iraq by doing kind of slanted oil drilling, and it was kind of like sticking a straw into Iraq's oil reserves from the side. I think there was also shock on the Kuwaiti side. We helped Saddam during the Iran-Iraq war, as you said, by dropping our prices, and now Saddam is trying to take all the oil.
Yeah, precisely. I think you see not only that, what happened during the Iran-Iraq war, that many contracts that Iraq had signed with foreign countries to export oil to them, those contracts were actually honored by Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. And that was the way they helped, and the cash went to Iraq to fight the war, you see. So, and after the war finished, the Kuwaiti said, give the money back, $14 billion. And, of course, Iraq had no money. But to the Bush senior's logic was very simple and very quick to understand that if Saddam has control of 20% of world oil and Saudis have 25%, then Saddam could become the swing producer. And that he would not allow. You see, that is the key point. And that is why this particular relationship has continued. But despite that, I think what really has amused me, and I think I have to really read you this, because as you know, that Condoleezza Rice was the director of Chevron, and she had a tanker named after her. And this is what she says in her testimony to the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee on April 2006. Condi Rice's words: "Nothing has taken me aback more as Secretary of State than the way that the politics of energy is, I would use the word, warping diplomacy around the world." Unquote. So I said to myself, "Oh my God." This lady was a director of Chevron, and her knowledge is so poor, because here is another quote from the State Department official in August 1945, at the end of World War II, and I read it: "A review of the diplomatic history of the past 35 years, since 1910, page 89, will show that the petroleum has historically played a larger part in the external relations of the United States than any other commodity," unquote. Now, that particular quote, Leonard, is in many history books. And here is this lady, Secretary of State, she's just realized, she's just reinvented her wheel. I know, I thought if she were my student, I would give her F. Honestly, this is not allowed. This kind of illiteracy is frightening.
Maybe it's just faux naivete. My guess is Dilip Hero, his book Blood of the Earth, The Battle for the World's Vanishing Oil Resources, is published by Nation Books. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, oil has played a part in world politics in many different ways. How did the Arab-Israeli Six-Day War in 1967 change the way oil was thought of in the Middle East?
I think at that time, of course, they occupied Sinai, and in Sinai, it was Israelis who first found oil in Sinai. But of course, when they made the final peace treaty with Egypt under Anwar Sadat, they quit everything. But of course, this was an important factor. That the main thing that really, you know, came up about oil was in 73 Arab-Israeli war. And it was not opaque. You see, if you read the news items or even scholars, they simply say OPEC organized the oil boycott of the Western world, etc., etc. No, it is not OPEC. OAPEC, which is Organization of Arab Petroleum Exporting Countries, which was quite different, based in Kuwait, they were the ones who said that we will not supply, we'll cut off supplies at 5% each month, and so on and so forth, until justice is done to the Palestinians, which of course never happened. But I mean that it was in 73 that oil weapon was used for the first time. And also, you see, what happens if you use something which has not been done before, then it's very effective. The second time around, if they say we're going to do it, because already those who are going to be affected, they have taken certain steps. But you see, countries with oil, they are really sitting pretty. Of course, you see how Putin of Russia is behaving, how Hugo Chavez is behaving. I mean, Hugo Chavez is running a country of 26 million people. And he's, you know, basically challenging Uncle Sam every day. You know what I mean? Why? Because he has hydrocarbons. You know, and that is what is changing, you know, the diplomatic and power equation in the world.
On the other hand, many of the oil-rich countries have experienced economic depressions of one sort or another. Nigeria sure isn't doing particularly well. Saudi Arabia, despite all the oil, I think the GNP is lower, and the average income of Saudi citizens is lower than it was 20 years ago. They become too dependent on this one export.
Precisely. I think, you see, again, one has to make a distinction, you know, and of course I make the distinction in my book. If you see Hugo Chavez and the figure that I have seen, when he first became president, 44% of the people in Venezuela were living in poverty. And last year, when there was election, 34%. So it has improved 1% every year over the past 10 years. And of course, not only is he helping them, but as you know, his program to give heating oil at 40% discount in the northeast of the United States itself was showed that he was trying to help poor people. But if you then contrast this the way Saudis run the whole system, and as you see, where I want to show how oil is important, I find that 4 of the 10 the richest people in the world, their money comes from oil, starting with King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. He is worth $21 billion. And there's another guy who is a Sultan of Brunei, he is $19 billion. Of course, another guy from Dubai, he's worth $18 billion. So I think that they are basically putting oil in their pocket. And how they do it, very simple. The crude oil is sold to a phony company, say at, say, $34, and that phony company sells it to the refinery at $38. And the $4 difference goes into the Swiss bank account of the Saudi or the Kuwaiti Riyal. And that's how they are, you know, milking and putting this money in their own pockets.
You were born in India. You've written about India and China as the largest growing nations responsible for adding to the demand worldwide for oil. In the light of the current availability of oil, how do you see India's future industrialization?
Absolutely. I think I'll give you, again, one simple figure, which is that in the whole world, there are 750 million vehicles. By vehicles, I mean passenger cars, buses, etc., etc. 231 million vehicles are in the U.S., and that means there are almost 800 vehicles for 1,000 American men, women, and children. In India, there are 8 vehicles for 1,000 men, women, and children. So there are 100 times more vehicles in the. Now, if we were to simply think, say, in India, they were to move from 8 vehicles to 18 vehicles or 80 vehicles, think of the amount of oil they would need. As for China, last year...
Well, China's been depending on coal until recently, but they're trying to make the switch, aren't they?
I think, well, you know, they're very big on coal, and that's part of their problem, you know. And that is, you see, you know, they are going to make something like 500 coal power stations over the next 10 years. But at the same time, they are going for nuclear, et cetera, et cetera. But you see, if you look at the oil alone, you see, the key point about oil is simply, you know, one barrel that's selling for, say, $55 today, what actually it gives you is worth $250. You know, if you were to secure that from other sources, it costs you $250. So oil is still the cheapest, the most efficient one. And last year, China's oil consumption went up by 15%. They're doubling their consumption every 5 years, quadrupling it every 10 years. And that is the crunch. And that's where that, you know, chart that I show on page 69, bell curve, as oil starts to come down, output, the demand from India and China is rising so fast that you will find oil be very expensive. In another 10 to 15 years' time, oil will be selling for about $200 a barrel.
So that's why the Bush administration has made coal emission standards a little lower, and that's why many people are calling for a return to nuclear power. What are your feelings about those approaches to hold off the total drain on oil?
Absolutely. I think the nuclear power has become much safer than before, you know, and there are now designs which are quite much safer, nothing to do with what happened in in the old Soviet Republic of
Ukraine.
And so
Chernobyl.
Yeah, but you see, you know, France, for example, gets 80% of its energy from nuclear power. So I'm just one example. And in terms of coal, of course, there is something called decarbonizing coal. You know, take the carbon out and then store it, underground or undersea, et cetera, and if that particular procedure is followed, which only costs about 15% more, then I think coal is okay in terms of CO2 emissions. But I think many of these companies even don't want to spend that 10-15% more.
And then coal and uranium are finite resources as well.
No, that's true, but I think there's plenty of coal. You see, and of course, there, if you're looking at most people who say the gas is the, natural gas is the one for 21st century. But even the gas, its peak will be about 50 years behind oil. So these two elements, which have been very important for human civilization for the past 100 years, they are on the decline, and of course others have to take over. And that's why, you see, my book is not like gloom and doom. That's why the whole chapter, section 3, deals with alternatives. I talk about nuclear issue. I talk about coal, and I talk about, of course, divorce between internal combustion engine and petroleum products. And that's where we can actually save ourselves from a great catastrophe if we continue the way we have been doing so far.
The problem with uranium for most people is not another Chernobyl, but what to do with the depleted fuel. And so far, no one seems to have come up with an answer. And nobody seems to want to have the stuff in their area. Nevada sure doesn't. Utah doesn't. Colorado doesn't.
I think, there is a particular plant in Finland where they are doing this. And Finland only allowed this nuclear thing after 30 years or so. They have found a way in which you can actually seal this thing, with the copper and iron, et cetera, and that becomes quite safe. And that is something to be watched. You see, one can either say, well, nuclear is finished, no, but I think one can improve on it. And there are different designs which are much safer, and that is one way of tackling the problem. Because see, the demand, from India and China are not just two countries. Between India and China, they are mega nations. You have 40% of the world population. 2 out of 5 human beings are Indian or Chinese. And when they industrialize at the speed of 10-15% a year, their demand for energy hydrocarbons is so huge that it's changing, world economics, world diplomacy, and so on. And that's something we have to take into account.
Dilip Hero's latest book is called Blood of the Earth, The Battle for the World's Vanishing Oil Resources. It's from Nation Books. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.